Here in the United States, we have a cultural practice of thanking members of the armed forces for their service. That thanks is almost always genuine. Not everybody decides to either commit themselves to protecting the country or to putting their lives on hold for several years to protect the country. So we thank them. In many cases, after a person has spent 20, 25, even 30 years in the military, they decide to start second careers in public service, and often in the service of other members of the military. I'm not talking just about the Pentagon, of course, but also about the Department of Veterans Affairs. So many of our active duty service members and retired veterans need help, and they often go to veterans' hospitals for that help. But what happens when you decide to dedicate your life to helping your fellow veterans and you see evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality? What happens when you see that the entire system is broken, that it's set up not to help people, but simply to check a bureaucratic box? You blow the whistle. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. We've spoken several times on the show about the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, that large governmental bureaucracy created to help and to serve the country's veterans. But for multiple reasons, the department has never run the way it was supposed to. Many veterans receive substandard medical care. Many are denied medications necessary to live their lives as normally as possible. And in another terrible development, according to MilitaryVeteranProject.org, 22 veterans commit suicide every single day. Some even do so in the parking lots of the veterans' hospitals where they've been denied care. Our guest today is Ted Blickwadle. He served his country for 27 years in the U.S. Marine Corps, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. He decided upon retirement to consider serving his fellow veterans, and he received counseling training and went to work in a Department of Veterans Affairs hospital before then moving on to the VET centers. The centers are community-based counseling clinics that were established in the wake of the Vietnam War, connecting social workers and counselors with military or combat experience to other combat veterans. That way, they spoke the same language, had similar experiences, and could better understand the pressures of post-military life. Ted began providing counseling for VET centers in 2009, but by 2016, he realized that what was originally a people-centered approach to helping veterans had simply become a numbers game where patients were rushed through appointments to meet Veterans Administration numbers expectations. Ted began to feel burned out, and he realized that other counselors were having the same experience. In 2018, he emailed nearly 1,300 VET center counselors across the country to learn how the VA's expectations and bureaucratic demands were affecting them. The results were so stunning that Ted decided to blow the whistle, resulting in a Government Accountability Office report that in 2020 revealed that the new productivity standards were leading to counselor burnout across the country. A bill to correct these wrongs is pending in the Congress, but it has not yet been acted upon. In the meantime, Ted has written a book called Broken Promises, which chronicles his experience and provides insights into how to report problems in government agencies. Ted Blickwadle, welcome to the show. We are so happy to have you.
Well, thank you for having me, John. It's great to be here.
Ted, let's begin with the end of your military career and the beginning of your second career as a counselor. What made you want to go into this line of work? Was it that you saw a need based on your own experiences?
Well, yes, I have a history of PTSD exacerbated when I was in the military. I am a combat veteran, was in the Persian Gulf War, and you know, I saw a great need at that time for our military veterans and even active duty that really needed a lot of assistance. And I've always had an interest in the counseling field. And so when I retired from the military, I went back to school, got another master's degree in clinical social work from Rhode Island College, where I then did an internship at the VA Medical Center in Providence, Rhode Island, and subsequently worked at the VA Vet Center in Warwick, Rhode Island for 9 years from 2009 to 2018.
Honestly, I can't think of many more important programs than providing counseling to our veterans who may be dealing with things like moral injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, or other mental health issues. We owe it to them to provide the best possible services. And you decided that your second act would be to help those veterans. When did you realize that there was a systemic problem?
Well, in 2016, a memorandum came out from the VA central office, basically increasing our clinical productivity expectations. And this policy was such that it increased the visit count with the standard visits of 50 to 60 minutes seeing individuals, whereby we used to have what was referred to as 50% direct service time. So out of a 40-hour work week, we were to have face-to-face time with veterans or their family members out of those 20 hours out of those 40 hours. Well, by this increasing the way it did and wanting 30 visits per week, what this meant was on a 50 to 60 minute session, this increased the face time that we were expected to have by 50%. So basically 75% of our work week or 30 hours a week in one-on-one type situations was required to meet that requirement, which did not allow enough time with all the additional administrative duties, progress notes, treatment plans, and such to be able to get everything done. So counselors were not taking breaks, working through lunch, and virtually putting in extra time that they weren't getting paid for just to get the administrative portion of their job done. And it just became stressful to the point where counselors were starting to burn out, taking FMLA leave, worried they're going to lose their jobs because of a memorandum that came out that if you don't meet the requirements, you're subject to HR, kind of interaction, which basically is setting you up to get fired, is what that kind of boils down to. So a lot of people were anxiety ridden, going on medication, seeing their own therapist and such. And so this put us in an ethical dilemma. Do we meet these numbers or offer the quality care that veterans and their family members deserve? And that was the position we were put in. And it just put a lot of pressure on people. And that's, this was around after a year from 2016 going into 2017, where over that year, this was apparent.
Like most whistleblowers, you went through your chain of command when you realized that there was a problem. And you went armed with data. You had sent this email to almost 1,300 other counselors around the country, so you knew that you weren't alone in your conclusion that the Department of Veterans Affairs was more interested in numbers than it was in actually helping individuals. What was the reaction to your revelations internally?
Well, actually, a lot of us counselors were talking. We had even, get this, a deputy District 1 director for the Vet Center program here in the Northeast, making rounds and doing clinical site visits. We unanimously were telling him at this site visit, we've got this problem that I was just describing. And he said, yes, I've heard that everywhere I go, meaning other vet centers where he was doing clinical site visits. That was significant. And he's still working at the VA too, Dale Willis. He's still in District 1 somewhere in his deputy, clinicals director slot in District 1 in one of the zones. And, it's just unconscionable. Nothing got done about it. We raised, and so at that point is when I went out with an email to the chief RCS Vet Center program officer in central office in Washington at the VA and described his problems, what it was causing, the compromised quality mental health care, the counselor burnout. Frankly, it's unethical. I have research in a book I published about the whole thing that backs up the fact that this, in fact, is unethical. And what they were asking was basically affecting there to be negative treatment outcomes because of going over a certain limit with visits per week. And, it just got out of control. And basically, when they failed to respond back to me, when Mike Fisher, the RCS chief officer, failed to respond to me after a week, I went out with that same email with additional comments. But this time, I CC'd, infoed everybody in the program, district directors, vet center directors, and about 1,300 counselors across the country. And at that point, it got a response. And what happened was, within 48 hours, after I'd already received 57 responses from 42 vet centers across 25 states. They had shut down my computer, otherwise I would have had hundreds of responses, all echoing the very same thing I was saying, how this is excessive, it's hurting us, it's a business model that's unethical, and we can't keep going on like this. And people just started, looking for other work, private practice, taking early retirement. And to this day, there's still an issue with a high turnover rate because of this.
It was then that you decided to go public with what you knew, and you went to the Government Accountability Office. That's exactly the place where you were supposed to go. That's the organization that's supposed to keep the honest people honest, so to speak, in government. They confirmed your allegations and turned to Capitol Hill for a solution. So I guess my question is twofold. First, with a finding by GAO that you were correct in your allegations, why didn't the Department of Veterans Affairs just correct the situation? And second, once a bill was written and introduced in Congress to correct the deficiencies that you found, why wasn't action taken on it immediately?
Okay, well, first of all, the reason action hasn't been taken based on the GAO recommendations that came out on the report in September of 2020 is because it's easier for the VA and any bureaucracy, that's guilty of misconduct and abuse, frankly, to silence someone that speaks up about it. It's a lot easier to do that than actually fix the problem and then them having to be culpable and held accountable for that. So that's just, basic retaliation tactics. That's a pretty standard operating procedure. And so as things move forward and the GAO, validates my allegations, this led to the Vet Center Improvement Act, which they allowed me to edit the bill on before it went to the floor for a vote. And basically, this legislation was passed and signed into law just this past December as an amendment to the FY23 National Defense Authorization Act. It's H.R. 7776, Section 5126, pages 819 through 825, and it lays out all the concerns and what the VA is required to do with GAO and congressional oversight. Now, in the bill, what it says is the VA has 1 year to actually start compliance with the bill, so they have time to get their ducks lined up, which means now going into 2024, they should be taking steps to implement what they're required to do with GAO and congressional oversight, which basically comes down to counselors having an opportunity to give feedback in an electronic database that cannot be altered by any party. And this is anonymous feedback where the VA is required to establish an internal working group to review this. Third parties are able to have access to this without it being altered, so the VA can't minimize things or trash things that they don't want to be known. And then the VA secretary, based on that feedback, is then required to submit a report to Congress based on the findings of any corrective action that's being taken.
Ted, please hang with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Ted Blickwadle about his continuing work to right these wrongs through a very well-received book called Broken Promises. Stay tuned.
By the middle of the 19th century, practically the whole of India had been under the rule of the British Empire. The colonial authorities had imposed a heavy tax, bringing the people into poverty, and were exporting natural resources. And moreover, these authorities absolutely had no consideration for the traditions of the local population, treating them like second-class citizens. The British were showing signs of disrespect even to those who cooperated with them. The fact of ignoring the religious beliefs of the Hindus led to the mutiny of the sepoys, mercenary soldiers serving under the British crown. The rebellion began on the 10th of May, 1857, in the garrison town of Meru, north of India, in the form of a mutiny. The rebels quickly took over Delhi. The heroic resistance of the Indian people lasted for 1.5 years. However, the forces were not equal. The colonial authorities dealt with the rebels cruelly. The enslaved sepoys were tied to the mouth of the cannon and were shot right through their bodies for the amusement of the public. This type of execution was called the Devil's Wind. The obliteration of the mutiny resulted in the death of 800,000 inhabitants of India. However, the British Empire never broke the free spirit of the Indians and their will for resistance.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs whistleblower Ted Blickwadle about his whistleblowing over the issue of counseling for American military veterans. Ted, it's good to have you with us. Thanks for hanging in there.
Thanks again, John. Good to be back.
Ted, you wrote a book called Broken Promises that has been very well received. The reviews are universally positive, and most reviewers describe the book as important. Did you originally set out to write a book, or was it something that developed over time?
Well, this is actually something that developed. I never intended, in fact, I didn't want to write a book, to be honest with you. Then people kept telling me, no, you got to do this, you got to do this. So I had a lot of encouragement, you know, that this could be very beneficial, not only to the issue, but other things. And so I decided to go ahead and start working on this in, I believe it was 2021 is when I started putting things together from documents and things I had written already as part of a journal. And it finally got published this past month, in August of 2023.
In the book, you talk about retaliation from superiors at vet centers. You talk about abuse and misconduct that you encountered while you were there. Tell us a little bit about that. And noting also that you are certainly not the first whistleblower to call out waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality at the Department of Veterans Affairs, why do you think it is that the department just can't seem to clean up its act?
Well, like any bureaucracy, it's like an aircraft carrier. When you try to turn an aircraft carrier around, you've got to go about 5 miles and it turns very slowly. So the wheels in a large bureaucracy like the VA, which is the largest healthcare system in the world, you know, that's something, unfortunately, to be expected because of all the red tape you got to go through to make any changes. But more importantly, anything that does need to be changed has got to get elevated to a level where they're going to be held accountable. And this is what happened when this legislation finally passed that I talked about in the last segment, that was important to that end. But what was also important is the local and national media interviews I had done with NBC, Military Times, NPR, and other networks, and getting political action galvanized behind this and following through on the House and the Senate side and with the Veterans Affairs Committee through my congressional delegates in Rhode Island, Senator Reid and Congressman Cicilline. And so that's kind of what made the difference to elevate this thing, to put the VA in a position where they can no longer just disregard, minimize, and try to make it go away.
One of the important parts of this book is near the end, where you talk about lessons learned. One interviewer said that it is something of a manual for potential whistleblowers. Have other potential or would-be whistleblowers come to you to discuss their own situations? And if so, what advice have you given them?
Well, absolutely they have, but I first just want to do a quick caveat about the book and its value to that end. The book was written to expose the issues with recommendations and what needs to be done in the legislation that's needed, which finally passed. So that's important. Also to raise awareness to the general public and politicians, what happens to people that speak truth to power. So I very viscerally and very on a very deep personal level talked about the impact it had on me with the depression, the anger, being emotionally isolated, the impact it had on my family, my colleagues. It was absolutely horrific, legal and financial consequences that were pretty bad, and consequently, you know, exposing that and giving it names. These are actually malicious tactics that are used, like mobbing, gaslighting, silencing, you know, counter accusations. And one of the things they did with me was try to paint me as a mentally unstable combat veteran to discredit me and you know, ruin my character as part of trying to silence me. These are some of the things that that happened, and the book details that in a very, very graphic way so people understand that. But then, you know, besides talking about the media and the political action that happened, at the end of the book, as you're alluding to now, is it gives people hope, whistleblowers hope, because congressional legislation came out of this, which is a very rare thing, actually, when people take on these kinds of causes. So it gives people hope to show that David can beat Goliath. And then number two, with my lessons learned, I have like a blueprint from my experience listing all the elements and explaining what needs to happen when someone speaks truth to power, what elements are important as part of the strategy in order to be maximally effective to have the most favorable outcome possible. And so that's what the book describes. And two of the most important things is, of course, having, or a few, is evidence, you know, backing up what you're saying, you know, with documents, with witnesses, with recordings, with whatever that might be. Self-care, very important, and make sure you get legal help up front, number one, before you march off, because you're going to fall into all kinds of traps if you don't, and it will not end well, as I found out in my experience, which is why I pointed that out in the book, along with the importance of establishing a network of support. And that's where I give advice on not just these things, but going to people like, and organizations like Whistleblowers of America, with Jackie Garrick, who's the founder and CEO of that organization, and also the National Whistleblower Center, because they help whistleblowers understand what's happening and what's being done, you know, and helping them understand, you know, how this all unfolds, so they can develop a strategy in order to deal with this and counter this and have the support they need, so they realize they're not alone. And it just goes a whole lot more smoother that way, because you learn things and avoid pitfalls that help you with your well-being and your health, as well as you know, having more of an effective advocacy effort.
Finally, Ted, tell us about the work that you're doing now with Whistleblowers of America and where people can learn more about what you're up to.
Well, I am a mentor for Whistleblowers of America. Jackie sends, you know, contact information to me of people that need to touch base that are starting out with, you know, whistleblowing for one reason or another. And so I'm involved in that sense because, again, it's a peer-to-peer support kind of thing that helps build a network of support so people can be referred to the different services they need along the way in their journey that meets their specific needs. And, you know, that way they have a connection that kind of helps along the way, so they're not going it alone, because you cannot do it alone. And so to find out more about this and the importance is to get the word out about my book. And the reason for that is it is the source document that addresses all of this, with references for the book being so massive, had to be, instead of in the book, on my website in the references tab in the menu bar for transparency and credibility. And it's important for people to understand these things I outlined before. The book is a great source for that. And it's the title is Broken Promises. It can be purchased on Amazon, as well as Barnes & Noble. And I have a website, www.vabreakingpromises.com. Again, that's breakingpromises.com, which not only where you can go to order the book and share and spread the word, you know, on social media platforms to raise awareness, because the focus now is to ensure that the VA complies with the legislation now that it has passed. And that's really my next step in this process.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with us, Ted. The great theologist Norman Vincent Peale once said that, quote, to be successful is to be helpful, caring, and constructive, and to make everything and everyone you touch a little bit better. And Martin Luther King reminded us that life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Sometimes there's a price to pay for doing the right thing, but the world is a better place thanks to people like Ted Blickwadle. And thanks to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.